Good afternoon, you are tuned in to a Juno Afternoon here for Wednesday, the 10th of August, the year 2016. Jeff Brown here today. We'll be getting a preview of David Woody's Thursday presentation about his art currently on display at the City Museum. We'll get the details on how to help with the annual Panhandler's Toy Run. We'll talk with author Stephen Levi about his new book, The Matter of the Vanishing Greyhound. That writer's almanac, Murnaut Museum, more today on a Juno Afternoon. The forecast for tonight, rain, low temperatures in the mid-50s. Forecast for Thursday, more rain with high temperatures in the mid-60s with light winds. Thursday night rain, Friday rain, high temperatures around 60 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal members arrested for major crimes on a reservation are prosecuted in federal court. Native people arrested off-reservation go through state court. Over the past year, the U.S. Sentencing Commission conducted a study to find out if that leads to harsher penalties for defendants who face federal sentencing. Federal Judge Jeffrey Viken of Rapid City, South Dakota, recently reported the study group's findings to the commission in Washington, D.C. Victoria Wicks reports.
Judge Jeffrey Viken says states don't collect the empirical data necessary to ferret out disparity, but he says there is a wealth of anecdotal evidence that the study group relied on.
The question really was to address what is a very strong perception in Indian country among defense attorneys, native peoples, tribes, families, state judges in some instances, federal judges in many instances, and some federal prosecutors, that the sentences are more severe for native people.
Viken says the disparities the group studied are not based on judges' preference for one race over another, but rather on differences between federal and state sentencing schemes. Although mandatory sentencing guidelines were declared unconstitutional in 2005, Viken says federal judges still have to consider them, and some judges follow them closely.
The perceptions in Indian country, and for many of us who have spent our lives working with Native people on criminal matters, we're convinced that there are very serious disparities, not based on race, but based on federal jurisdiction. There's a pretty strong view that the federal sentencing guidelines are not very useful in Indian country, that that's not a happy marriage.
Viken told the Sentencing Commission that Congress could make federal funding to state criminal justice agencies contingent on their collection of sufficient data. And the group recommends constant communication between federal agencies and tribes to determine more clearly what effects federal sentencing guidelines are having on tribal members. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
When ricing season gets underway later this month in Minnesota, tribal members won't need to buy a state license to harvest rice off reservations. The new policy is having mixed reactions. Reporter Melissa Townsend has more.
The new Minnesota law says tribal band members who possess a valid tribal ID from a federally recognized tribe in Minnesota are deemed to have a license to harvest wild rice. But some tribal members have mixed feelings about it.
Well, they've got words in their law that says what is and isn't required, and right now there isn't a fee required under their law. Well, they change their laws every year.
Frank Bebo is executive director of the 1855 Treaty Authority. It's a group of tribal members pushing for official recognition of 1855 treaty rights. He says the new law removes a hassle for tribal members, but it doesn't get his group to where they want to be. They want the state to recognize tribes' rights to gather all types of plants and animals in the 1855 treaty territory. And they want the state to recognize tribes' rights to reject any development that would endanger those plants and animals. The 1855 Treaty Authority is specifically opposed to the proposed Sandpiper and Line 3 oil pipelines that would run through the region. I'm Melissa Townsend.
The Center for Native American Youth is inviting young people to apply for a chance to attend the White House Tribal Nations Conference in Washington, D.C. Eligible applicants need to be between ages 14 to 24 from a federally recognized tribe. Those selected will take part in the event alongside tribal leaders through the White House initiative Generation Indigenous. President Obama announced Tuesday the 8th and final Tribal Nations Conference to be held September 26. It provides representatives from the country's 567 federally recognized tribes an opportunity to interact with high-level federal government officials and members of the White House Council on Native American Affairs. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the year-long celebration of Native American artist Lloyd Kiva New at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, the IAIA Museum of Contemporary Native Arts, and the New Mexico Museum of Art. Info at nmculture.org/LKM. And by Humboldt State University's online Master of Social Work program, which focuses on decolonizing work with rural and indigenous communities. Applications accepted August 1st to 31st at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into a June afternoon. My first guests are David Woody and Jane Lindsay. Jane's from the City Museum. David Woody has a show at the present time. Thanks for coming down to the station tonight.
Thanks for having us in, Jeff.
Thank you.
So you're having a show about your show tomorrow night.
Yeah. Yeah, I've gotten a lot of questions about it over the years about the type of work that I do, and so I've kind of always situated it in a broad area of narrative painting. It's actually, I use that definition very, very loosely, very broadly. I kind of draw the line to far enough out to include quite a few things that sometimes aren't considered narrative, but I think they're in each case they represent some sort of a suggestion of a story.
Your paintings are on display at the City Museum now, and you'll be talking tomorrow night about the paintings. What made you decide you were an artist?
When I was 6 years old, I had a friend named Gordy who could draw dinosaurs really, really well, and I loved it. And so I started drawing sailing ships, and it's just been a long haul since then.
Other than your friend, were there other inspirational people?
Yeah, quite a few. A lot of the narrative painters of the past. I don't consider myself a surrealist, but I think that surrealism's had a big effect on me. And I would say also that on just about every artist of my generation, singer-songwriter paradigm has had a big influence. I've always really admired Bob Dylan and, you know, the singer-songwriters that emerged out of the late 60s. And I think that kind of open-ended narrative has really had a big influence on a lot of artists of my generation.
Besides Salvador Dali, what were some other surrealist painters?
Jindřich Heisler is a Czech guy that I've been kind of interested in. I can never – what's the woman's name? American woman, I can't remember.
Dorothea Tanning.
Dorothea Tanning, yes, is another one. I've looked at all of them. I can't really pick just a couple of them. It's just a general Max Ernst. All of the, you know, well-known surrealists have had some influence on me.
I think of Magritte not so much as
sure.
Content, but just the beautiful kind of precious
style.
Painting. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, similar technique and style. I actually really admire Magritte, and I think something I really am grateful for is that all of those artists really saved the basic ideas of academic painting through the period of time when that was largely being abandoned because people were moving towards abstraction. I grew up with that myself, actually. I think it's funny that most of the abstract expressionists from the New York School late in their later life, they began to consider going back to, if they lived to a later life, they considered going back to some sort of figurative kind of painting. And it's been the opposite for me. I grew up with that, and I've always been a figurative painter, but I've always been drawn toward abstraction. So maybe one of these days I'll get there.
Interesting.
What medium do you use most?
I use oil paint almost entirely. I use acrylic a little bit for sketching. And sometimes for an underpainting, if I figure I'm going to make a lot of changes, because it's easier to make changes with acrylic, but it doesn't have much subtlety, at least not in my hands. I've seen people who use it really well, but I'm not very good with it. It dries too fast. I use all kinds of different media for drawing, which is sort of the core of what I do. All of the figures in all of these paintings all come from drawings that I did either in my studio or out at the university in one of my classes. And in that case, I use charcoal. I kind of go for the three-color technique using a sanguine kind of red chalk sort of color, and then black and white on a toned ground. Use the white for highlights. It's an old technique, an old French thing. Actually, it goes back 40,000 years.
Tell me about the show that's hanging at the City Museum now.
Excuse me?
Tell me about the show that's hanging at the museum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about it.
Oh, well, it's 13 paintings. Half of them or so, a little bit less than half of them have human, or no, about half of them have human figures in them. They're paired sometimes with landscapes. They're paired in several different ways. There's some that are multi-panel and some that are overlaid kind of images. They're, like I said, pretty evenly split between figures and landscapes.
When you paint, is there a schedule you paint on? Like, is it 9 o'clock, it's time to start painting?
Boy, no, I wish I could do that. I've kind of tried to force myself to do that sometimes, but no, lately I've been painting at night. And I kind of got in a habit of being a night owl when I was teaching night classes at the university, and since then I've still kind of tended to do that. I'm trying to push it back a little because I'm beginning to realize that at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm not really at my best. Used to be, but I'm not really anymore.
Tomorrow you're going to be talking about the paintings themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll show some slides of influences and periods of time and specific artists that have influenced me and how they specifically have influenced me. And then I'll finish off the talk with a quick run through of the images that are in the gallery now.
Tell me more about the narrative style of painting.
Well, it's a broad category, and it's sometimes called history painting, and that is actually a mistranslation of an Italian word, historia, which British and other European people translated as history, but it actually means story. So it's really any kind of painting that that either suggests a story, or traditionally a lot of times it actually they were like illustrations of a story. One of the slides that I'll show will be the Velázquez painting The Surrender at Brega, which is commemorates a particular event in Spanish military history. And that's what a lot of these paintings, a lot of narrative painting is like, is it records some kind of a biblical story or a historical event of some sort. But at the end of the 19th century, people moved away from that. They didn't want to have the allegories and the stories and the telling moment or any of that kind of thing in the paintings. They wanted to do art for art's sake alone. So the subject matter of the paintings became less important, and the actual form of the painting became more important. But surrealists maintained that interest in what the content of the image is. And I think that's kind of my point of departure, and I think it's a point of departure for a lot of people these days. Sometimes it's kind of pushed into the category of postmodernism. I'm not sure if that really works or not, but neither is anybody else. So.
Do you work on more than one painting at a time?
Oh, yeah. I have. This is a fairly complicated oil painting technique. It's sort of pared down or simplified from a Venetian painting technique, very similar to Venetian technique, but it requires that you leave the paintings to dry for a period of time now and then. And I also really, it takes me a long time to decide whether I like something. And so they sit against the wall quite a bit. One of them that Jane has up in the museum there, I worked on over a period of 4 years, and there was quite a bit of that time when it was sitting against the wall. It was a charcoal drawing for a couple of years. And sometimes it takes me quite a while to get settled with it, imaged, and decide that it's something that I like. And
how do you know when it's finished?
I don't. I don't. I've never been able to figure that out. If somebody buys it and it walks out of the room, it's done. It belongs to somebody else, and I won't change it after that. But anything else, these paintings that are in this show, if they don't sell, I may take them back to the studio and work on them some more. No telling.
We have, Jeff, just as a little side note, we have had artists hang work, and they try to come back in before the opening, of course, and work on it or make some touches up to the painting. And we usually say, no wet paint, please. So Woody's been very good about that.
How long does it take oil paint to dry?
Well, it depends on how you're using the paint and what kind of a medium that you use with the paint. And lately I've been using a lot of alkyd medium. The brand is Liquinin. Works really well for most everything I do. Once in a while I still use sticky medium or various other kinds of mediums that dry a little slower. But with Liquinin, if you use it with the paint correctly, it'll dry pretty much overnight. I mean, you can continue to paint on the image the next day, depending on what, on exactly what color you're using. Some whites are really hard to overpaint, and so they have to dry a lot longer. But generally, I can work steadily on a painting. I don't have to stop too long. But every now and then, I will let a layer dry for a week or two.
Do you paint from pictures, your imagination?
Well, I try to make sure that every single image is an invention in the final result. So I don't use photographs unless I have to. The figures I like to do from life, and what I'll do is I'll make a drawing, and if I like the drawing, or if I like part of the drawing, let's say I just like the upper half of the body and not the lower half, then I'll transfer that drawing, have the model come back in, and I'll just have the upper half. So I'll be that much further ahead than I was the first time I started. And then once I get a drawing that I like, then I'll transfer that and make the painting off of that. I almost always use life drawings. Once in a while I use a photograph, but usually just if that's someone that I've had in the studio quite a lot, you know, and I know they're facing me. I'm not a very good photographer, and I can't get a lot of information into a photograph. So I always end up kind of stumped working from a photograph because I just can't. Usually they're small, and it's really hard to see the details and things, and I don't really know how to work a camera well enough to really get the kind of clarity that I want.
What qualities do you look for in a model?
Well, the kind of models I like are the ones that are there. people who have some time are very good. People really vary in terms of what makes them interesting. There's a huge range, and I have no idea. I really don't know what makes a good model until I start working with somebody. And some people I just really click with, you know. Other people are more difficult. Sometimes that is good. Hard to say, but the main thing that makes a model good is when they show up.
One of your paintings, it was turned into a postcard, and it just has a human hand on it.
Oh, yeah. The Work, I think, was the title of the painting that you're talking about, or there's a couple of them that have hands in them. Traditionally, artists have put hands in paintings, in portraits and things like that, because it kind of emphasizes what the person does in life, their agency. There's a great Diego Rivera painting of a woman named Lupe Marin, who he was involved with for a while, and he has foreshortened the image. She has her hands, her fingers clasped around her knee, and he's exaggerated the foreshortening somewhat, so the hands are really big, and it makes her look like a strong person who does things. So hands work that way, and I've just decided to be really completely literal about it and just throw a couple of hands up there. And that, I think, has that kind of effect on the image.
All hands on deck.
Yeah.
Jay, how did you decide to bring David? He was working in the studio, in the museum.
Well, he's, you know, we've seen his work for years, and actually the museum has a couple of pieces through the years that we've collected, and I just think he's a very sophisticated, unique, and original artist, of course. And we often like to show, not every summer season, but we often like to bring artists into the gallery, in our temporary gallery, and then that gives us a break to do other exhibit planning. But I'm really proud to show him to visitors, because I think there's such a mystique about, Alaska and the last frontier. And I like, and perhaps people don't really know this, but we do, here's David Woody, who entered his experience here as a fisherman and a lumberjack, doing these incredibly sophisticated old school paintings. And I like the idea that this is how we live and who we are. I think this is a good way to look at who our community is. And, you know, frankly, I think he's one of our most sophisticated and prolific painters. And he's very unique. So, hey, and he's here in Juneau. So that's my mission, right? That's our mission.
How long is the show up for?
The show is up until the end of October.
And tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, you've invited the public
in. Yes, 7 p.m. at the museum. We're across the street from the Capitol, and it's free, open to the public. And what's great is a great venue, and we'll be right in the gallery where the paintings are. So I'm really looking forward to learning from Woody, too, because I believe he's got such a nice grasp on art history, which personally I find very interesting. And to be able to look at artists through time and painting styles and types of painting and then sort of relate that directly to his work, I find that just wonderful conversation and a great way to spend an evening.
How long of an evening will it be?
How long of an evening will it be?
Well, it depends on how long we go. We're talking about the paintings. I'm aiming for the slideshow and a quick talk about the paintings to be 45 to 50 minutes.
Yeah, we're thinking by 8:30 is, you know, that's what I had, 7 to 8:30, yeah. So, yeah.
It kind of depends on how much we talk about the slides and things, but I'm going to try and keep it from going over 50 minutes.
What are the hours for the museum?
Sure. We're open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m.
You close Sunday?
We are closed on Sunday.
Anything you'd like to end, I might have forgotten to ask.
No. Our number is 586-3572. If you need to give us a call, or you can find us on the web, or we have a Facebook site as well. Is there? I think that's good.
Is there a way for the public to support the museum?
You can always become a friend of the Juneau Douglas City Museum, and you can go. We actually have a friend's website, and if you go to the museum's main page, it's down at the bottom, and it'll jump you over to the friends. But there's lots of ways to support the museum. Give me a call. We have so many volunteers. We have people who actually donate Juneau history to us, and also people who are members. Yeah, there's many ways to support us. Yeah.
David Woody and Jane Lindsay, thank you so much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for having us in, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 10th of August, 2016. It was on this day, 1519, the explorer Ferdinand Magellan set off to sail around the world with a fleet of 5 ships and 270 men. They set sail from Seville, heading to the west. He became the first European to enter the Pacific Ocean from the east, and he's the one who gave it the name because it was so much calmer than the Atlantic. He did not make it around the world. He got involved in tribal warfare in the Philippine Islands. He died in a battle in April of that year. The fleet continued without him, and they got back to Seville September 1522 with 1 ship and 18 men. It was on this date in 1793 the Louvre opened as a public museum on the right bank of the Seine in Paris. It had been a palace, but the French Revolution was in full swing. 1793, Louis XVI had been imprisoned by the National Assembly, which had seized the buildings and its contents, and it was open to the public. Today it's the world's largest museum. It's the birthday of the poet Joyce Sutphen, St. Joseph, Minnesota, 1949. Grew up on her parents' farm with 9 brothers and sisters. Got her doctorate in Renaissance drama, and then on a break from her studies overseas, she sat down and found herself writing poetry. Joyce Sutphen, who said, "Poetry makes the world real for me. In the end, it isn't hard. When I sit down to write a poem, one thing just leads to another." It's the birthday of the novelist Suzanne Collins, Hartford, 1962. She'd written a children's book series called The Underland Chronicles when she was struck by the similarity between reality television and the coverage of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she turned that into a trilogy about a future in North America in which young people are forced to fight to the death for their country's amusement. It was The Hunger Games, came out in 2008. And it's the birthday of the poet Lawrence Binyon, born Lancaster, England, 1869, famous for his poem For the Fallen, written about the dead of World War I. They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning we will remember them. Here's a poem for today by Joyce Sutphen, My Luck. When I was 5, my father, who loved me, ran me over with a medium-sized farm tractor. I was lucky, though. I tripped and slipped into a small depression which caused the wheels to tread lightly on my leg, which had already been broken when I was 3 by a big dog who liked to play rough. And when I was 9, I fell from the second-floor balcony onto the cement by the back steps. And as I went down, I saw my life go by and thought, this is exactly how Wile E. Coyote feels every time. Luckily, I mostly landed on my feet and only had to go on crutches for a few months in the 5th grade, and shortly after that, my father, against his better judgment, bought the horse I'd wanted for so long. All the rest of my luck has to do with highways and ice, things that could have happened but didn't. My Luck, a poem by Joyce Sutphen from First Words, published by Red Dragonfly Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by LegalZoom, supporting small businesses with formations, corporate filings, and independent contract and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
27 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into it in the afternoon. Our next guests in the studio are Craig and Dan and Katie. Katie's at the hospital, and Craig and Dan are with the Panhandle Motorcycle Club. Thank you for coming down to the station, everybody.
Hey, good to see you this afternoon.
First of all, tell me about the Panhandlers.
Ooh, tell you about the Panhandlers. Well, we are the local motorcycle club, if you will. Been around for, I don't know, what, 27, 28 years now?
I think it's more like 38. 38 years, actually, is about what we're at right now.
Oh, I guess I was thinking of one of our parties that's been going on that long. My bad.
Yeah. Established in 1978. So we've been around a few years.
The 22nd annual toy run, how did it start?
The toy run basically started as an effort to benefit the kids in the community that were either having problems or dealing with the emergency personnel or the hospital personnel, just kind of something for the comfort the kids in having problems or, you know, experiencing some kind of trauma. Or.
And if you would have come by the clubhouse 22 years ago or so, you would have seen Easter egg hunts. You would have seen a lot of the members that were younger than they are now that had their own kids. And when something happens and the kid goes to the hospital and stuff, it's traumatic. And being able to see that and being able to do something about it by, you know, just with our efforts and stuff to help soothe the kid when they get in the in that kind of situation was something that was a no-brainer for us. We were like, that's something we'll absolutely love to do. So we put our efforts in. People just don't understand how long it actually takes to make that much food, to smoke that many ribs, that much pulled pork, and do all the collection. We have so much help from people around who see every year what it does. We when a child is in the hospital and you you can see the look of terror on their face because it's not something they're used to. It's not something that they want to be a part of. When you can ask them, what's your favorite cartoon? What's your favorite animal? What do you like? And they say dinosaurs or Barney or something like that. And you can just walk right down to the stockpile that is generated through the toy run, and you can find a Barney, or you can find a Porky Pig, or you can find a stuffed animal and take that. For just for a minute, it takes their mind off what's going on because they focus and they concentrate on that, and their memories roll back to the cartoons and the fun stuff, and it takes all that away. And for that reason right there, the 22nd annual toy run is in existence today, because just the feeling you get when a kid or their parents especially come up and say, hey, I just want to thank my kid had a broken ankle and was in the ambulance and they had a couple of stuffed toys from you guys in there. The feeling that you get from that just makes it completely worth it. We don't take anything off the top of this. This is something that we do just for the absolute joy of doing it for the children.
Well, how many animals do you pick?
Oh, we've...
What I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, really, we have several pictures of the back of the run van that we have filled. We put a tarp out, and then we filled probably a quarter of the run van before with stuffed animals. We've filled the cage at the hospital and the box that they have there. We've filled those to overflowing many times. We always hope for a good turnout, but sometimes when it's rainy out...
and it gets a little sketchy, that's true.
But we just want to make sure that everyone knows the invitation for this isn't for motorcycles. This is for anyone who wants to come be a part of the toy run, come down, eat, fellowship with everybody, see the donation, just the massive amount, the plethora of different kinds of toys. Just come down, check it out, eat, donate, everything will benefit the children and the smiles on their faces. And the kids come down and we always make sure the kids eat first and they have plenty. So,
yeah, Jeff, this is quite an event, this toy run, the annual toy run from the panhandlers for Bartlett Hospital to supply our bin of stuffed toys to hand out to kids in the hospital. So it's really quite an enterprise. So right now we're collecting toys. The toys are being collected at the Triangle Bar at Louis and Douglas.
That's correct. Yeah, anybody that can't make it or doesn't care to come down and partake in the scrumptious ribs and whatnot, you certainly feel free to take any donations to either of those locations at any time.
Right, so the event takes place on Sunday, August 21st. So if you're a biker, you can line up at Donna's restaurant right in the valley
at
1
correct.
O'clock.
Yep.
And you can bring a toy at that time. Is my understanding there's also, if you want to donate at least $10 to the fund to buy toys, you can do that as well. And then the toy run goes from Donna's to the fire hall in Douglas, where there's, as these guys have been talking about this, I can't wait. I'm already waiting. I can't wait to eat all that stuff.
Yeah, actually, what we do is we meet at Donna's, and then we do a loop through downtown with the fire truck, and we stop at the Triangle with the fire truck, and we gather all the toys that they were donated at that location and put them in the fire truck and then leave from there and go across the bridge to the fire hall in Douglas.
Wow.
Do they have to be new toys?
Yeah. We prefer them to be new, so there's not any the problems that could come with smoking homes, things like that. So we just prefer new toys. And then we have had, like she said, in the past, people who don't want to go to Walmart or to Fred Meyer's or places like that to get a toy. You can donate $10. And many times in the past, when we didn't have a good turnout for people who were donating toys, we had enough that they donated to the tanks or to the $10 fund that we were able to go and just clear the shelves at Fred Meyer. And previously, the reason I said Walmart is we previously cleared their stuffed animals with money like that because we didn't have enough toys donated, so we just took the money, went and bought all the toys we could find and took those to the hospital. So there's a couple of different ways to help us do this, and you don't actually have to show up, but it's a really, really good time and a lot of fun. You'll see people you haven't seen in a long time, and it's for a really good cause.
Have you heard back from the hospital or the people who work there? It's the favorite toy?
Actually, I don't know if there's a favorite.
I have not heard either.
I think that someone keeps donating Nerf guns, and I don't think that is the favorite by any stretch of the imagination, but it is funny.
Yeah, but I think Craig kind of hit on that earlier, is that it really is the individual child. You know, if there's a certain character or animal that a child really resonates with a specific child, then that's the important thing.
Right, and it even, I mean, you can, even any child would love to have Patrick Starr, you know, or SpongeBob, or something, depending on the age, you know, anything like that. So there's a lot of... You know, there's a lot of favorites out there, but there are some standbys that you can get that no matter what, the child's going to like.
You know? And, Jeff, you know, I'm new as the community relations director at the hospital. Jim Strader, who previously had this position in the last 7 or 8 years, was kind of the point person on this from the hospital. But today I was able to get a tour of the area where the toys are kept. And this is kind of a basement area at Bartlett that the fire truck or a truck will, you know, drive up to with a couple of motorcycles, and another day after the party on the 21st to deliver this massive amount of toys. And from what I could see, that the supply is kind of going down, so we definitely need donations. And this is an area of the hospital that is accessible to nurses or healthcare providers any time of the day if they need to go get a brand new stuffed animal to comfort a child. So we really want to thank the panhandlers for their commitment to this annual event now in its 22nd year.
That's amazing. You're doing a great job. Thank you very much for doing this.
Well, thank you. It's fun to work for the community. I think overall, or you asked me earlier, Jeff, what started all this. I think this was our response to we originally started off donating to some national runs, and we were slightly dissatisfied with the return. So much stuff left town. But now, with the help of the hospital and organizations like you guys, we've been able to pull this off, and it's just been a wonderful thing. It's great.
I'm just saying the magic between the communication between the kid and the stuffed animal.
I'm sorry. I missed that.
Yeah. He was thinking about the communication between the child and the stuffed animal.
That is the key, isn't it?
That Jeff is enamored of that idea, which is just wonderful.
Well, that's what you'll find is when you know that even the guys that we talk to with the fire department and stuff, they are more in the know of what actually happens when they can actually be there and see a kid get something that's in the ambulance or with the first responders or someone that has those toys that are available. Rather, they can see that it takes some of the fear, some of the anxiety, some of the nervousness away from a kid who's in a situation that they're not used to. So, I mean, it's for us, it's a win-win. We don't actually have to see it. We know what the end result's going to be from all our efforts like this, and that's what makes us. And believe me, if you've ever smoked a rib, you know that it's not a quick process. The rubbing of it, the hours before, the letting it sit in the rub, and then we do them for 14 hours. So it's not just thrown together. It's something that takes a lot of work, and we take pride in it. Our food is among the best served in Juneau. We eat it ourselves. So,
and that's the reward if you donate a toy, right?
That's right.
That will take place at 2 o'clock on the 21st Sunday at the Douglas Fire Hall.
22nd, isn't it? What's the flyer say?
21st.
21st, okay. The 20th is the rodeo then.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
The next time.
Yeah. So do you want to go over the general...
Sure. So the general plan, to my understanding, is right now donations are being taken for toys.
That's correct.
Right?
Absolutely.
At Louis and the Triangle. Okay. So then Sunday, the 21st of August, at 1 o'clock, the riders will be lining up with their bikes to make the run to...
The Triangle.
The Triangle.
Yes, the fire truck will be leading the way.
With the fire truck leading the way. This is a Douglas Fire Department truck.
That's right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they will load it up with toys there.
In front of the Triangle, and possibly the motorcycles might be a little noisy for a second or two, but not for long. And after the toys are all loaded up, we'll all hoot and holler and head for the food.
And the food is at the Douglas Fire Hall, 2 o'clock.
And if people need more information, is there a phone number they can call?
There is a phone number they can call, and see here.
What number did we give them? Did we give
I
them?
Think you'd want to call Brillo, but and I I don't have his number in front of me, but I think that, you know, we do have some media out there, Jeff. There's going to be an ad in the newspaper. There is a poster around town, and I think we can get something.
There it is.
Yeah, there you go.
723-7838.
Okay, so it's 723-7838. At 723-7838 if you have a question about the Panhandlers' annual toy run.
Anything like that I might have forgot to ask?
Anything? We just like to remind people, you know, you don't have to be on a motorcycle. You know, this is a, you know, a community event that everybody's welcome to participate in, and you don't have to have a motorcycle. You know, if you want to ride behind us in the run down through there, that's fine. Honk your horn, whatever. If you just want to show up at the fire hall in Douglas, that's all fine too. But this is Juneau. One thing I want to remind you is if you decide to ride a motorcycle and you decide to bring your stuffed animal with you on your motorcycle, a garbage bag over it or a makeshift rain jacket or something for the toy is always appreciated, because we have seen some teddy bears that come in a little drippy. just a little drippy.
About how many bikers do you expect to see?
We did a count a couple of years ago where we had 170 people that actually showed up, but there were two on some of the bikes, so it was probably 120 motorcycles, and a lot of people said they didn't know there were that many motorcycles in Juneau. But it's usually when the sun is out that kind of a run happens. Last year, I believe it was kind of wet, and we may have had 40. So, but you know, the hardcore guys, they don't mind if you, you know, are in Juneau and you're afraid of the rain. You may be in need of rethinking your location for sure. Not much you can do without getting a little bit wet.
Well, that's the forecast for the weekend anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, and that's the run. But if you want to meet at the fire hall, I know I plan to just ride my bicycle down the hill in Douglas to the barbecue on Sunday the 21st at 2.
All right, awesome. Craig and Dan and Katie, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff. And for more information, too, if people want to go to the neighbors section on Sunday in the Empire, there'll be all the details right there.
Don't forget, drive-bys are welcome.
Yep. You can just drive by and drop it off.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you, guys.
Clear. This is Bird Note. The Ramsey Canyon Preserve in the Huachuca Mountains of Arizona is famous for the clouds of hummingbirds that swarm around its feeders in late summer. But the tiny aerial acrobats are by no means the only attraction. Rare and spectacular, elegant trogons are also found here. Elegant describes well this emerald green and poppy red bird, its white tail feathers marked with scrimshaw-like designs. A native of Mexico and Central America, it breeds in the United States only in a few of Arizona's southern canyons. These canyons drain the rugged mountain ranges called Sky Islands. Pairs of trogons set up housekeeping each summer in Ramsey and other canyons. Although brilliantly colored, they are surprisingly inconspicuous as they perch quietly. They are on the lookout for large insects and fruits that they pluck from trees while hovering in flight. They nest in natural cavities or old woodpecker nests, mostly in the beautiful white-barked sycamore trees that line the canyons. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann, inviting you to drop into Ramsey Canyon via our website, birdnote.org. Treat yourself to trogons and hummingbirds like these black-tinned hummingbirds.
This election season, 360 North will bring you complete state election results live. On Tuesday, August 16th, voters will pick their party's candidates for seats in the U.S. Congress and the Alaska Legislature. Winners will move on to the November general election. Visit 360north.org for voting information, election stories, and results. After the polls close on election night, watch 360 North TV for results as they come in. 360 North is Alaska's source for state public affairs information.
It's about 12 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned into it June afternoon. On the phone with me now from Anchorage, author Steve Levi. Steve, how are you doing?
Pretty good. How's your weather down there?
It's raining.
Oh, what a surprise.
How's the weather up in Anchorage?
Well, it's not raining, but it will rain tomorrow night, so what can I like it.
You're the author of several books. You want to give a brief biography, please?
I do a lot of books. I have 80 out in print and on Kindle. The Alaska history is an important one to me, with both the Alaska Gold Rush and current political issues. My most recent book on Alaska is Dead Men Do Come Back, and it's a murder mystery set in Juneau during the Alaska Gold Rush.
And you've come out with one recently, The Matter of the Vanishing Greyhound.
The Matter of the Vanishing Greyhound takes place in San Francisco at the current time.
How did it come about?
The Vanishing Greyhound, I like to write what are called impossible crimes. And an impossible crime is where the crime is committed in such a way that the detective has to figure out how it was done as well as catch the criminals. In the Matter of the Vanishing Greyhound, as an example, there's a Greyhound bus, and in the Greyhound bus you have four bank robbers, $10 million and 12 hostages, and they have told the police that they want to go to the San Francisco International Airport. And the police say that's fine. Everybody gets into the bus. The police start following the bus. The criminals decide they want to go to Sausalito, which is across the Golden Gate Bridge. And the police say that's fine because they'd rather have the Greyhound bus on the Golden Gate Bridge than driving through the streets of San Francisco. So they follow the bus and until it goes out onto the Golden Gate Bridge. They close off the Golden Gate Bridge, figuring that the Greyhound bus is out there. And they go out, and there is no bus. The bus has vanished. And so now what the detective has to do is to figure out how the criminals made the bus disappear, and then he still has to find the criminals and the hostages and the money.
This is kind of like a locked room mystery.
Yeah, a locked room mystery usually has a dead body in a room, where they've found a body in a room and it's dead and they can't figure out, you know, how the person did it. But I don't like murders. I like robberies.
Your protagonist is Captain Heinz Noonan. You want to tell me about the captain, please?
Heinz Noonan is an older guy out of North Carolina, and he is past retirement age, and now all he does is show up at the office and answer questions about unusual crimes that may happen across the country. And a lot of the crimes he solves are just on the phone. People will call him up and say, hey, we have this crime, here's this situation, do you think you can solve it? And then he says, well, let me ask you some questions, you come back with information, then I can see if I can solve it from my desk here in North Carolina. So he's not an active detective anymore.
In general, where do your ideas come from?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, what happens is I just start thinking and I start trying to come up with things that shouldn't happen, and then I try to figure out a way to make them happen.
Do you have a work schedule, a writing schedule?
Not really. What happens is I spend about 2 hours a day writing, but I do all kinds of different writing. Usually the ideas come to me in strings. What happens is I'll have three or four ideas that will come to me, and I'll put them down, and I'll try to figure out, how would you do something like this? Like, for instance, in one particular story, I had cargo that was gaining weight while it was flying. And I was saying, how can you get cargo to gain weight while it is flying? You know, and so you'd sit down there, I would write it up, and then I would think about it for a while, and after maybe a week or two, I'd say, oh, okay, I've got an idea of how to do this. So it's not like I can sit down and just write them flat out. What happens is I come up with a problem and then have to throw it around in my mind.
Do you know what the end is going to be before you start writing the beginning?
Generally, I know where I'm going, but I don't know really how to finish it until well into the book. I always want to end up with something that you have to read it right till the last line on the last page, because there's always something left to discuss.
Now, this is called The Vanishing Greyhound, The Matter of the Vanishing Greyhound. And it kind of reminds me of the David Copperfield magic trick about the Orient Express, where he vanishes an old railroad car.
Yeah, that's kind of magic. And so what he's doing is, Copperfield is entertaining you with magic. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to figure out how you can use the magic, or use the basis of magic, which is, you know, the idea that you're watching one thing and you've been misdirected, and because you've been misdirected, you miss important clues. That's how magic works. David Copperfield does something, and then if you think about it long enough, you can say, well, you know, I could do that if. But he did it right then, and it happened.
How long have you been writing?
I've been writing since the 1970s, so was about 50 years.
What's your favorite kind of book to write, or do you have a favorite?
I like to do history and nonfiction, and then also I like to do what's called creative thinking. Creative thinking is teaching people how to solve problems that cannot be solved by being logical and rational. To give you an example, let's pretend that you are a high school principal, and you come in on Monday morning, and you look and hear the flagpole out in the football field has completely covered the tires. Over the weekend, a couple of kids have gotten a crane and they've taken these tires and they've thrown tires over the flagpole. Well, you've got a homecoming game on Friday, so you have to get those tires off by Friday. It's Monday. You don't have the money to be able to hire a helicopter or a crane to get the tires off. You can't really use, it's far too dangerous to use a chainsaw. But the tires have to come off. How do you get the tires off the flagpole? Now, logically and rationally, you can sit down and come up with all kinds of different ways to get the tires off the flagpole, but most of them won't work. So what do you do? How do you solve that problem? With a creative thinker, what you do is you teach people to go ahead and stop looking at the problem logically and rationally, to look at it from a different perspective. And in this particular perspective, what happens is most people are looking at the tires as being the problem. Okay, the tires are really not the solution, though. So what you do is you stop looking at the tires and look at something else. Well, the other thing that you can look at is the flagpole. And the way that they solved the problem was by getting a forklift, raising the tires up enough that they could get in and unscrew the flagpole from the base. And then they pulled the flagpole out. Okay, the creative thinking is as long as you stop thinking logically and rationally, the tires are the problem, and then you start thinking about something else, a different angle, a different perception, then you can solve the problem.
Interesting. How can people get a hold of your book?
That particular book, you should be able to get it in a bookstore. If not, you just get online and go to Publication Consultants. It's a publishing company here in Anchorage, and you can buy it online.
All right. Anything like that I might have forgotten to ask?
No, but I just look forward to going down to Juneau and meeting the readers down there.
And do you know when that's going to be?
No, but it'll probably be in about 2 months.
All right.
I will let you know.
And you can be on the show live in person.
I'll be down there in person, and we can do an interview if you want to do one in person.
All right. Thanks so much, Stephen Levi.
Okay. Thank you, Brent. Thanks for the interview.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Will computers become conscious? Can string theory help us travel to the stars? Join us, Seth Shostak and
Molly Bentley and
KTOO News, Friday nights at 8 for Big Picture Science.
Big Picture Science gives you a weekly look into the latest developments in science and technology straight from the people perched on the precarious cutting edge.
So think big, broaden your horizons, and get the scoop with Big Picture Science.
Friday nights at 8 o'clock on KTOO News, Juneau.
What we most often hear is bad news about our teens. That alters what we know is true. Most Alaska teenagers are doing positive things. They're volunteers, role models, and much more. Spirit of Youth tells these stories.
Youth musician Zach Bordelon grew up in the Anchorage music scene. Knowing how hard it is for kids under 21 to get in and book shows, he decided to use his permanent fund dividend to rent out Anchorage Community Works for a night of all ages music. He'd call his event Space Fest. Bordelon began planning about 4 to 5 months in advance. In all, he spent about $800 to get things organized. He sold tickets for the event, knowing that he probably wasn't going to make a profit.
We didn't make the that much money back, which I knew was going to happen. I made the tickets really cheap to attract more people to come.
Tickets were $5 each, or 2 for $8. The project wasn't about getting his PFD money back. It was about showcasing all ages music and supporting local bands.
I know people personally who they feel like going to concerts with local bands are like the only place where they can really just go and be themselves. And I know there's a lot of bands who want to have more shows and they feel the same way.
All right. We are Tamlin. This is I Help You Crash Your Car.
Hammerfist, Dutch's Droning Machine, and Bordelon's solo project called Brother Spaceman all made the lineup. The hard work paid off, and Spacefest was successful.
I thought maybe we'd fill up half the venue and all that, but actually we almost sold out. It was over 100 people.
Spacefest surpassed every expectation Bordelon had. He plans to host it again next year, making it an annual event with more people and more bands. I'm Kendall Stormo.
Do you know of a teenager making a difference where you live? Take some time right now to nominate them for Spirit of Youth. Get more information at spiritofyouth.org.
You're just about the top of the hour and you're tuned into a Juneau afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, periods of rain, low temperatures in the mid-50s. Forecast for Thursday, more rain with high temperatures around 60 degrees. Thursday night, more rain. Friday, rain. Friday night, rain likely. Coming up next, more music.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas.